This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. 20 years ago, a huge number of Americans were glued to their television sets, watching, of all things, C-SPAN. The country was riveted by what had been an unspectacular proceeding, a Senate confirmation hearing of a Supreme Court nominee. Clarence Thomas was poised to replace Thurgood Marshall on the High Court. Marshall had been the first black justice. He was appointed by Democrat Lyndon Johnson. Thomas, a well-known conservative, was nominated by Republican George H.W. Bush. Anita Hill had worked for Clarence Thomas when he was the chairman of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC. And that was before he became a judge on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. She accused Judge Thomas of sexual harassment, and those accusations dominated Thomas's confirmation hearings. Listen to Anita Hill responding to Senator Alan Simpson.
Today I feel more angry about the situation. Having looked at it with hindsight, I think it was very irresponsible for an individual in the position of a kind of authority, as was Mr. Thomas at the time, to engage in that kind of conduct. It was not only irresponsible, in my opinion, it was in violation of the law. Now I'm much more divorced from it. I'm less embarrassed by the fact that I went through that. After having gone through what I've gone through now, I'm less embarrassed by it. It's still embarrassing. It's embarrassing that I didn't say anything. But I'm angrier about it. And I think that it needs to be addressed by this committee.
Do you have anything to gain by coming here? Has anybody promised you anything by coming forth with this story now?
I have nothing to gain. No one has promised me anything. I have nothing to gain here. This has been disruptive of my life, and I have taken a number of personal risks. I have been threatened, and I have not gained anything except knowing that I came forward and did what I felt that I had an obligation to do, and that was to tell the truth.
And Clarence Thomas made accusations of his own, famously putting the all-white, all-male Senate Judiciary Committee on defensive.
This is a circus. It's a national disgrace. It is a high-tech lynching for uppity blacks who in any way deign to think for themselves. And it is a message that unless you kowtow to an old order, you will be lynched, destroyed, caricatured by a committee of the U.S. Senate rather than hung from a tree.
Well, the Senate eventually confirmed Clarence Thomas by the slimmest margin in over a century. Today, Anita Hill is a professor of policy at Brandeis University in Massachusetts. Clarence Thomas is a justice on the Supreme Court. The 20th anniversary of their face-off led us to wonder what those hearings meant to race and gender relations in America then and now. We asked Duke professor and author Carla Holloway to join us, and I'm pleased to welcome her back to the program. Carla, welcome.
Pleased to be here. Thank you for having me.
A lot has been said, was said at the time. Much more has been said since. What was going through your mind as you were watching those hearings unfold?
I was riveted. I was one of those up late at night watching C-SPAN before the days of TiVo, where you could listen to it later, and just impressed with both the performance of the hearing. I remember the green cloth across the tables, the microphones, the formality of the room, and what was being and then what was being said in it. The sort of juxtaposition of those two things. And frankly, I think at this moment it was still that very formal space, having the intrusion of a very private and heinous behavior that stays with me today, the inability of that space to contain the words of either of them, and certainly the kinds of fractures in both in folks who would identify with feminism, folk who would identify with a black community, although we know now how that term is really does not explain much of anything, because this was, you know, black people were quite divided during this moment. Feminists learned more, I think, about race during that hearing than they were able to understand.
How much did we learn? There was that famous line uttered by Clarence Thomas. This is a high-tech lynching. He said that to a group of all-white men, the majority of whom were nominally liberal.
Right. It was an extraordinary line, and I think it was probably the moment at which the hearings were determined, because this was a black man. Black male bodies were generally often associated with lynching. Speaking to white men, white male bodies were the ones who were historically the lynchers. Both of them understood that kind of positionality. And when he said that, and they saw themselves being clustered into a group of white males whose conduct during the centuries before had been vicious and horrific, there was only one way for them to go. To disassociate themselves from that image, to leave Anita Hill's claims behind, because they certainly could not be a lynch mob. It was an extraordinarily well-fashioned phrase. I've often wondered who gave it to him.
It's a phrase, however, that is in opposition to the claim by a woman about essentially sexual violence, sexual right. mistreatment, also a crime. Why would it have been possible to make the countercharge that that phrase had been misappropriated in this case, that another kind of violence was also at stake here?
Well, this is the problem, and I don't think just with America in the 1990s, but the United States now. We see race politics and gender politics differently, although that hearing in and of itself should argue for their intimate intersectionality. And it's almost as if we can't contain the idea of, okay, this is either about race or this is either about gender violence, and one or the other, but please don't ask me to put them together because I don't get that. I think this was on display then. This is on display in contemporary Durham politics. You know, is it about race? Is it about gender? About university issues? So our inability to understand that intersectionality is a lesson to all of us to think in more complicated ways about identity, about violence, about the selectivity violence does not have, but might have a consequence on all dimensions of one's personhood.
This was a fracture, though, that had been apparent for a long time.
Absolutely.
Certainly in feminist circles, the inability to somehow bridge the conversation about race and gender was well known and well described. Was this a failure on the part of say, progressives to come to terms with this before that time, to really find a better way to negotiate this?
I think it certainly was. The opportunities were there. In academic feminism, black women and white women have consistently engaged this discourse around, well, is there an intersectional politic here? But even at the last week's conference at Hunter College, I heard Gloria Steinem say, who received appropriately a wonderful introduction, but the first words out of her mouth was something like, I was raised disproportionately by black feminists. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, this sounds like a version of The Help. In other words, they, black feminists, were not who she was as a white feminist. So 20 years later, Gloria Steinem, parent of the movement, is still trying to negotiate where she is when race and gender politics collide, and not understanding that whiteness is a part of that racial politic.
I know you were particularly interested in the degree to which Anita Hill herself was on display.
Absolutely. It surprises me. I kind of thought I had just started writing about privacy, but I realized, oh my goodness, I was writing about privacy shortly after the hearing. I wrote a book called Codes of Conduct that began with the testimony of Anita Hill and how the display of her body, not just her well-groomed, carefully coiffed self, was there in front of the Senate hearing, but she had to talk about intimate parts of her body, her breasts, pubic hair. I mean, the room almost exploded with that kind of language. And it was, in a way, display of her body that never interrogated in the same way what Clarence Thomas did, was accused of doing. But she was easily dissected before that committee as if, well, we've got to get to the bottom of this. Tell us where, how, what. And she spoke so cautiously and carefully and, I believe, truthfully. And yet the words she were saying were not given the kind of weight the kind of consequence that one would argue they should have.
It goes back, doesn't it, to the setting that you talked about, the fact that this is a hearing, it's a quasi-judicial-looking body. I heard Anita Hill recently in an interview, and mm-hmm. someone asked her about the allegations that you'd made about Clarence Thomas, and she corrected quickly and said, not allegations, testimony.
Absolutely. And testimony is the phrase which does remind us that this was a Senate confirmation hearing. And what she was saying, she had sworn to. So once they're allegedly is outside of the courtroom. When you raise your hand and swear to tell the truth, it becomes a different kind of text. It is testimony, and it is sworn to a value that people still don't understand, that the context of her telling was the context that required her to tell the truth.
I wonder if we've found the kind of institutions and the sort of media to negotiate the conversations that we've had. If you think about the fact that this gap is still with us, the how we negotiate gender and race. You know, Clarence Thomas in that statement said something. He talked about a lynching, but he also talked about caricature. So again, the sexualization of the black male, it's something that hadn't been a demon that had never been exercised from the American consciousness. So it raises itself again. We have to come to terms with it still, in the 1990s. And I would say here in the 2000s, we haven't come to terms with it, and yet we've been talking about it. Do we have to find a new way of talking about it, new institutions to navigate?
You know what I think? I think who's missing from this conversation are white folks. White folks analyzing and understanding their own presence in the midst of this. I was talking to a class yesterday, and race for them still means other, still means black or Latino or Asian, but whiteness. So I think once whites understand they are as involved in these identities as each one of us is, then everything's on the table. I think as soon as some people think we're talking about those other folks over there, Joe Biden is a perfect example. You could see his disarray.
He was the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee at the time, yeah.
Right. And his disarray in trying to, well, let's see, how shall we do this? That we have so much time. He kept trying to place it into a schedule, into an architecture of an understandable space. And you could see he was just personally undone by this moment. And I think it was because of the same reason that well-meaning white folks don't see that they are as clearly involved in this history of race, gender, sexuality in this country as every one of us who is easily seen as the other.
And our responses to it and the way we bring ourselves to the conversation is overlaid by our sense of what we have to lose,
right,
a certain amount of privilege or not, a sense that we've already lost. All those things are part of the conversation. We're not sitting sort of above.
Right.
The
what if we were all at the table equally and together? Then I think we would be able to assess the realities, to share the experiences, to understand someone else differently, someone else's shoes differently. But if we think we're removed from it and that's those people talking about their experience, we had a black man and a black woman. How do people understand that? I mean, people were talking about at that time, the people who were on her defense team or on her team of advisors were saying they would leave the Senate hearings and get in the taxi cabs. And people would be saying that, what does this black woman have to say to keep a black man off the court? So, even those politics within race seemed not to be able to understand the complication of gender.
And even today, we continue to talk about it and wonder about the legacy. Anita Hill has spoken about it herself, looking back on the hearings. Here she is just a couple of weeks ago talking with Glenn Ifill.
I have often say to people that you really don't get to decide your own legacy.
I mean, what you do is you try to be your own authentic self. And then people decide how they're going to interpret that and what it means to them. If I can mean to people, if I can symbolize the ability to pursue gender equality, racial equality, and to be truthful about our experiences, then absolutely, that's what I want to be.
That's Anita Hill on her own legacy. Carla Holloway, what is the legacy for this nation in the wake of these 20 years later?
I think the legacy is the lesson of her strength, her courage, her integrity, that 20 years later, she reminds us that to whatever extent we can be in control, we have to understand that there are outsiders who will also have a comment. So conduct oneself with truth at the center and be not afraid to tell that truth. I listened to that interview with Gwen Ifill very personally and took courage from it in terms of, okay, your truth is the only thing that you can represent. And if you have the courage to represent that, then that part of her legacy is something that you might be able to honor.
Carla Holloway, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank.
Carla F.C. Holloway is the James B. Duke Professor of English and a Professor of Law and Professor of Women's Studies at Duke University and the author of several books, the most recent Private Bodies Public Texts, Race, Gender, and the Culture of Bioethics. Thanks for listening to The State of Things. You can go to our website, find out about events, including one Friday, November 4th. That night, we're going to be at the Haw River Ballroom in Saxapaw, along with playwright Howard Kraft and some of the cast of Jade City Pharaoh, a new radio drama series about a black superhero. It premieres soon on The State of Things. Going to be a big event. Take a look at that, and we want to see you out there at the Haw River Ballroom on November 4th. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a public service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.